The sit-in by House Democrats is slowly ending this morning on Capitol Hill after Republican leadership pushed through adjournment of the House until next month. Democrats want to vote on gun legislation following the mass shooting at a gay nightclub in Orlando. The Senate this week voted down new gun regulations. Proponents of stricter gun laws want individual states to take action. But, as WBUR's Anthony Brooks reports, there's not much research to back up arguments on either side of the gun control debate.
We hear again and again that Massachusetts has some of the toughest gun laws in the nation. They include restrictive licensing agreements, safe gun storage rules, a ban on semi-automatic assault-style weapons and large-capacity magazines, and rules that allow local police chiefs to deny gun permits. But do they work? In a piece we reported last week, we heard John Rosenthal, founder of Stop Handgun Violence, say that Massachusetts makes it very difficult for criminals to get their hands on guns.
And that's why we've been able to reduce gun deaths in the state by 60% since 1994.
But we also heard from Jim Wallace, president of the Gun Owners Action League of Massachusetts, the local NRA affiliate, who said this.
Since the 1998 gun laws were put in place in Massachusetts, gun crime actually tripled, while the rest of the nation's gun crime was declining.
So what's going on here? As we reported last week, Rosenthal and Wallace are looking at different time periods and measuring different things. For example, Rosenthal looks at all forms of gun violence, while Wallace omits suicides, which account for the majority of the country's gun deaths. But what do we really know about guns and about how well gun laws work?
There are so many things we don't know whenever you scratch the surface.
This is David Hemenway, a professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and director of Harvard's Injury Control Research Center. He says among the reasons we know so little is that Congress, abetted by the NRA, prohibits the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health from using federal funds to advocate or promote gun control. Speaking recently on the public radio show Science Friday, Hemenway says this has a chilling effect on the study of guns.
CDC has been afraid to do gun research and has been really afraid to even say the word guns. If there's any research and it looks bad for, it indicates that maybe having a gun in the home is not such a good thing, then often CDC gets brought in front of Congress and gets beaten up.
The result has been a dramatic mismatch in the allocation of research dollars. For example, in the United States from 1973 to 2012, there were about 2,000 cases of cholera, diphtheria, polio, and rabies combined. Compare that to more than 4 million gun injuries during the same period. But during those years, the NIH funded almost 500 studies on those infectious diseases, and the number of studies on gun safety? 3. So Hemenway says there's a lot he'd like to understand about guns.
I mean, one of the many things I would like to know is who is using these guns inappropriately and how did they get these guns? We really don't know. We know so little about gun theft, about gun storage, about gun training, about concealed gun carrying. You name it, we hardly know anything.
But that could change. Just this week, following the massacre in Orlando, Florida, the American Medical Association called gun violence in the U.S. a public health crisis and says it will begin lobbying Congress to overturn legislation that blocks federally funded gun research. In the meantime, we do know a few things about gun laws. For example, here's a finding from Eric Fliegler, a pediatric emergency physician at Boston Children's Hospital and an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School.
What we can very clearly state is that if you live in states that have higher numbers of laws, the likelihood of dying from a gun is significantly lower.
Back in 2013, Fliegler authored a study that was published in a journal of the American Medical Association, which looked at the relationship between gun laws and gun deaths. He found that between 2007 and 2010, states with the most gun laws, like Massachusetts, had 42% fewer gun deaths than states with the fewest gun laws, like Louisiana. Fliegler says the study showed a dramatic correlation between the number of people who own guns and the number of gun deaths.
In states that have more laws, what you see is that the firearm ownership rates go down. So in other words, less houses own firearms. And as the firearm ownership rates go down, you see a very dramatic drop in fatality rates.
He found dramatic drops in both homicides and suicides. But Fliegler's study only goes so far. It shows that more gun laws are generally associated with fewer gun deaths, but there's no proof that the laws are responsible. In other words, correlation does not imply causation. For example, it could be that states with low rates of gun ownership are more willing to enact gun laws, and the study can't say which gun laws work and which don't. But David Hemenway of Harvard says the idea that fewer guns in the home lead to fewer deaths has been borne out by several studies.
One of the few areas where we have incredibly good, solid research is the fact that a gun in the home really increases the risk of suicide, and it increases it dramatically, maybe threefold, for everyone in the household. And that's one of the things we really, really know well.
Another thing we know is that without federal action on guns, it's left up to individual states to enact gun laws or not. This creates a patchwork in which a state like Massachusetts has relatively restrictive laws that are compromised by nearby states with less restrictive laws, like Maine and New Hampshire. And where a state like Florida permits Omar Mateen, who'd been on a terrorist watch list, to buy a military-style rifle with a high-capacity magazine. This week, once again, Congress left that porous patchwork of laws in place. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks.
One of the leaders of the sit-in is Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark, who's on the line with us right now, joining us from Washington. Good morning, and thanks for speaking to Morning Edition.
Oh, it's good to be with you, Bob.
Our understanding is the sit-in is still on, but winding down after GOP leadership forced that adjournment. What's the scene right now?
So we still have members on the floor talking about the issue. But once the Republican leadership adjourned the House at about 3 a.m. this morning, we know that we are not going to have a vote on this bill before 4th of July break. And it was sad to see the Republicans really double down on cynicism and not bring a vote on two very practical measures to help curb gun violence before they went on 4th of July break.
So given that, what's next for you and your Democratic counterparts trying to push these two pieces of legislation?
Well, we'll be back on July 5th, and we will be talking over the break, and we will have a presence at our informal sessions that will be held. And we are not going to let go of this issue. It is so critical. Not only to the families that have been affected and devastated by gun violence, but really to the American public to see that Congress can respond, that we are not so in the vice grip of special interest groups like the NRA, and that we just want to have a vote. Let's have the debate. And let's have a vote and be accountable.
But I'm wondering, considering the Senate this week already rejected essentially the same gun control measures that you want the House to vote on, do you see any realistic chance of getting those proposals to pass and become law?
I think we'd have a chance at passage if Republican leadership let their members vote their conscience. But do I think that's likely to happen? I don't, unfortunately, after the events we saw yesterday on the House floor. But what I think is that at this point, after so many mass shootings, after losing 33,000 people a year to gun violence in this country, that we have to start somewhere. And if it is just a vote, even if we ultimately lose it, at least we have that. People are accountable. Members of Congress put themselves on record. And then it's up to the voters to decide if that's the representation that they want.
So then it's almost the bottom line, isn't it? Considering it's an election year, is the real goal trying to force the issue deeper into the consciousness of voters in the hopes that it'll get congresspeople elected this fall who would be willing to toughen gun laws, if not this session, then next session?
The real goal is to make sure that we are doing everything we can to protect the American public, and that we do not accept as some sort of grisly routine these massacres, the children we lose, the moms, the dads, the grandparents every day in this country. And we are going to do everything we can to say no more silence, because that's the only action that this Congress has taken, are moments of silence. It's time to speak out, and it's time to act, and it's time to vote.
So does that mean when you come back on July 5th, there'll be another sit-in? Will you stage another sit-in if you have to, if you can't get Republican leadership, if you can't get Speaker Ryan to schedule a vote?
I think that is definitely one of the possibilities. We're going to look at whatever tactic we can. I think we're also watching what the Senate is going to do. Are they going to have a negotiated bill that comes forward? So we haven't taken anything off the table, but I also think that we are turning the tables on this issue, and we have allowed an opening to have the American public weigh in and to see the spontaneous demonstration of people who were out in front of the Capitol that stayed all night, even when it started raining, really spoke to how much this issue resonates and that we need to do something. And it's long past time that this Congress set a vote on these issues.
And one last question, Congresswoman Clark, if I might. As we said that after the GOP leadership adjourned the House at 3 o'clock this morning, your sit-in started to wind down, but you pointed out some folks, some Democrats are still in the chamber. Will they abandon the chamber at some point today, or is there a possibility that a few might hang in through the summer?
I think that we will wind down today, as the chamber will at some point be closed. And but I think that this issue is not going to it's not going to fade. It's not going to fade here, and we are going to make sure that it stays front and center on the agenda, and that we continue to push for a vote from this leadership. You know, whatever way you come down on it, it's long past time that we have the debate on two very common sense proposals, and that we put ourselves on record so that everyone can see where their member of Congress stands.
All right. Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark, one of the leaders of the sit-in, trying to get a vote on gun control legislation in the House. Thank you very much for giving us a call and speaking to Morning Edition on WBUR.
Thank you, Bob.
As the Boston Globe and the work of its investigative journalists continue to be celebrated around the world in the wake of the movie Spotlight on the clergy sex abuse crisis, the newspaper is again in the middle of cutting back. Managers hope to know by the end of this month if enough staffers have accepted a buyout offer to prevent layoffs. The Globe is also preparing to move from its home of the past six decades on Morrissey Boulevard in Dorchester to a modern space in downtown Boston. For a look at the future of the Globe, we visited Editor-in-Chief Brian McGrory at the soon-to-be-vacated headquarters in Dorchester.
This place here on Morrissey Boulevard has served the company incredibly well for many decades, and I've loved being here. I've spent the bulk of my adult life working out of this building. Many people here have. But the industry has changed, and this organization, this institution has changed with it. And when you walk around this newsroom now, when you walk around the building, you can't help but see ghosts of times gone by. When we launch into a new space, it is going to be geared toward a 21st century metropolitan news organization. We won't be seeing the memories. We'll be seeing the future, and we're all very, very excited about that.
When I walked into the building and looked around just a little bit, there are quite a few empty spaces. And the building, while, as you point out, has served you well for almost six decades, feels a little tired in a way.
Tired. It's exhausted. My God, you couldn't come up the escalator because that thing hasn't worked in several years or a couple of years. You can liken it to an old Victorian where we raised a big, vibrant family, and now the kids are all have gone on to their own thing, and we still got all this empty space here that we're banging around in. It'll be really, really good to get into a space that's far more suitable to what we do now, which is in some ways that are not inconsequential, different than what we were doing 15, 20 years ago.
Last month, the Globe announced another round of buyout offers, which followed a buyout last fall. What brought you to this?
Well, what brought us to this is what's bringing virtually every major metro and national news organization to the same thing, and that is that, quite simply, the revenue that's coming into the paper doesn't support the amount of money that we're spending right now on everything we do, and we're constantly looking for ways to cut and to create a sustainable news organization that will be around for a long time to come.
Are you getting enough takers for the buyout offers to avoid layoffs?
We'll see. That we're still in progress on the buyout. I'm extremely hopeful in the newsroom that we can avoid layoffs, but I won't know until the buyout period is over, which is at the very end of June.
You spend as much time dealing with newspaper finances as you do with journalism?
I spend too much of my day dealing with numbers and not words, which can drive me crazy. I grew up in this newsroom. I've been a writer my entire career. The part of this business that gets me going is the journalism part, holding people accountable, telling people things they wouldn't otherwise know. And the idea that so much of our time now is devoted to making ends meet here and everywhere is no small amount of frustration.
All of this happens at the time when the newspaper is also enjoying the wild success of the film Spotlight, which brought worldwide praise for the investigative journalism side of the Globe and its expose on clergy sex abuse here in the Boston area. Is the timing causing cognitive dissonance in the newsroom?
I think that's a little bit strong. Look, the Spotlight, the movie, has been wonderful for the institution. What the Globe did back in 2001, 2002, 2003 was a once-in-a-half-century story. I will say that we're not just looking at history, though. The Globe was a Pulitzer finalist last year for public service for a Spotlight report on decrepit student housing in Boston. We have doubled the size of our Spotlight team here. We have redoubled our efforts at accountability reporting at the Globe. We're not looking at this is the way it used to be and this is the way it is now. We are every bit as engaged in investigative and accountability reporting as we've ever been. So that kind of cognitive dissonance does not happen.
Sports section, whose audience arguably includes some of the most ardent Globe supporters and readers, will the sports section be taking a hit at some point?
Oh, the sports section has gradually been taking somewhat of a hit. We understand readers come to our site and to our print paper in no small way for sports, just like arts aficionados and others come for arts. And when you're making choices about creating a self-sustaining organization, there are no good choices.
Given all this, I'm wondering if you're bullish or bearish about the future of the Globe.
I'm bullish because for a variety of reasons. We are as well-positioned as a news organization can be. We have just an extraordinary amount of talent in this room. We have an ownership team, John and Linda Henry, that have told us point blank, we do not need to make a profit here. We want to be civically engaged. We want to figure out a model that the rest of the industry can follow. So just break even, figure it out, create a sustainable organization. Much of what we've had to do to be self-sustaining, we have done, and I think it's going to pay off in a huge way very soon.
Long-term future. Will the Boston Globe continue to be the newspaper of record for readers across the region?
The newspaper of record thing is now fallacy. We're not trying to be the newspaper of record now. The newspaper of record is something that you read in 1998. We are trying to be the paper of interest, and we have been for years now. Gone are the days when we had a staff that allowed for us to have reporters in every courthouse, 13 people in Washington, 8 people abroad. We are now trying to tell interesting stories that engage people and important stories that hold people in power accountable.
Brian McGrory, good luck to you.
Thank you, Bob, very much. I appreciate it.
Brian McGrory is editor of the Boston Globe.